Great pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you for inviting me to give you the opportunity to talk about what I think is a very exciting scientific project that's been going on now for almost 30 years, the development of large-scale gravitational wave interferometers. The work that I'm going to talk about represents work of hundreds of people that make up the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, and a lot of that work will be summarized in my talk tonight. The picture that you see on the slide is a computer simulation, supercomputer simulation of two black holes that are colliding. And that nice colorful thing that you see coming out of there is actually the ripples in space-time that come from this coalescence of these black holes and the generation of gravitational waves. And the goal of the gravitational wave, LIGO is Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, is to find and probe these black holes. It's really fitting that we start back about 125 years ago with the Michelson-Morley experiment. This probably is the most famous experiment. It's actually a failed experiment because it didn't detect what it was looking for. That's the so-called ether that defined a preferred reference frame. Interferometry has grown dramatically since that time, and today, here is where we are. This is LIGO. This is actually one half of LIGO. This is the LIGO Livingston Observatory. It's located near Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Its sister is located in Hanford, Washington. There are three interferometers that sit in these two observatories. They are 4 and 2 kilometers long, respectively. And their job is to look for gravitational waves. Now, to understand what we're looking for, I have to take you on a little tour of general relativity, and there's going to be some math that's going to be involved in the next couple slides. Don't be worried, I don't know a whole lot about general relativity, but I'm sure that we can walk through this together. General relativity is basically a theory of gravity that's based on geometry. It basically equates mass and space. Matter and space are equated through the theory of general relativity. In fact, gravity is geometry, and general relativity can be summarized as space tells matter how to move, it follows the contours of space-time, matter tells space how to curve. All right. The quantity that we work with in general relativity is the space-time metric, it's g mu nu, and that defines the geometry, and all of the stuff, the mass, goes into that g mu nu, that's a tensor. All of us in this world live in weak gravity, which means that space-time is locally flat. All right? Basically, space is Cartesian. There's also time folded into this. And all of the effects of gravity are perturbative. So this extra term, which is circled in red, h mu nu, is very, very small. What effect does that have? Well, if you can look here, let's see if I can get... You'll see that where we have a massive object, space becomes curved, and the reason that the Earth, the smaller massive object, orbits around it is that it's following basically straight lines there. And one of the most famous general relativity experiments was the prediction of light bending by the sun. And you can see that light follows a straight line and it follows this geodesic curve. Now, where do the gravitational waves come in? Well, as the Earth is orbiting the sun, it's actually radiating. It's not radiating much, but it's radiating. And those radiations form ripples outward. Mathematically, you can show that if I go through rigorous general relativity, that these perturbations actually look like a wave equation. So people in the audience probably recognize the equation that's for basically the propagation of a wave. So gravitational waves are basically ripples in space-time which propagate outward. All right, now let's go into advanced general relativity, and I promise this is probably the worst of it. What is the effect of a gravitational wave on masses? Let's take four masses and let's sort of configure them as an L. Let's put one in the y direction, one in the x direction. The masses have to be freely falling. What that means is that they can't have any other effective forces on them. They have to be only affected by gravity. All right, and let's calculate what would happen when a gravitational wave passes. All right, if I go through the formalism, well, let's send light from one of the masses, the near mass to the far mass, both in the x and y direction. Light travels on so-called null geodesics. That means that ds squared equals zero. If I calculate the round trip time for that light, what I find is that there's a delay due to the fact that along one path, the light is actually delayed, and on the other path, it's actually advanced relative to if there were no gravitational wave around. And the magnitude of that is given by basically the amplitude of that gravitational wave, h. All right. Now, instead of thinking about it in terms of time delay, because I want to do interferometry here, I'm going to turn it into length. So what's the displacement? The displacement is basically c times the time delay. And if you write that down, you can see that h, this amplitude of this wave, is a strain. It's delta L over L. This is what a gravitational wave looks like when it passes. It alternatively stretches space in one direction and compresses it in the other direction. There are two polarizations. The other polarization is sort of cocked at 45 degrees. So what we're trying to do in LIGO, we're trying to measure that effect. And it's a small effect, and you'll see how small in a second. Since this is an optics community, it's appropriate to actually compare gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves. And there are some similarities and there are some differences. Electromagnetic waves come from time-dependent dipole changes in the dipole moment. So electric fields basically come from moving charges. They travel at the speed of light. They're solutions to Maxwell's equations. They have two polarizations. Gravitational waves they come from Einstein's equations, and they also travel at the speed of light. But they're quadrupole in nature. They are strictly dipole forbidden simply because, first of all, momentum and angular momentum are conserved, and you cannot get radiation from dipole radiation from a gravitational wave. They also come in two polarizations, as I've shown you earlier. Right. How do you make a gravitational wave? Well, you could try it at home. If this scientist basically has decided that he's going to try and make a gravitational wave, he's going to take two 1,000 kilogram objects and he's going to spin them at 1,000 times per second and 1 kilohertz. And because he's somewhat smart, he's going to go into another laboratory about 300 meters away so that when the masses fly apart, he won't be there. If he had done the calculation before he tried to do the experiment, he would know that he's in trouble and it's a hopeless experiment because the strain that he would try and measure is 10 to the minus 36. So there's really no hope of doing gravitational wave generation and detection in a laboratory. So where do you go? Well, if you look at the form of that equation, you can see a couple of things. First, you can see that the reason that this amplitude is so small is that there's a c to the fourth sitting in the denominator and a g sitting in the denominator, and there's a g sitting in the numerator, and it's hard to beat that. The only way you can beat that is by having a lot of mass. So it's natural to think about going out into space. So let's consider a more realistic scenario, at least in terms of gravitational wave generation. All right, let's consider a 1.4 solar mass binary pair. In this case, it's white dwarfs that are orbiting around one another. Now, as they're orbiting around one another, they're radiating gravitational waves. And as they're radiating gravitational waves, the orbit is decaying. All right, if you put in the numbers for this particular situation, this is a realistic astrophysical scenario, what you find is that h is now 10 to the minus 21, which is still a formidable task to try and detect that. But nevertheless, it's a lot bigger than trying to do this in a laboratory. So I want you to hold that number, 10 to the minus 21, in your brains, because we're going to come back to that in a second. What would the gravitational waveform look like that would be generated from this system? The answer is it's something that most of the ultra-fast people in the audience are familiar with. It's a chirped wave. So as the gravitational wave is, these objects are moving around, they're radiating, and as they're radiating, they're losing energy. As they lose energy, their orbit is collapsing. As the orbit collapses, they actually speed up. The rotation speeds up, they radiate more, right? And so the pulse that comes out is a chirped pulse. It's sort of chirped towards the blue. If you were to look at it as a spectrogram, it would look something like this, basically at low frequencies, there's not much amplitude. As it spins up, it becomes a much, much greater emitter. What did Einstein think about gravitational waves? Well, this is quite an interesting story. Einstein predicted gravitational waves in his famous papers of 1916 and 1918. But he later did a calculation, and he actually changed his mind. He reported in a letter to Max Born that he, together with a young collaborator, I arrived at the interesting result that gravitational waves do not exist, though they had been assumed they had been assumed a certainty to the first approximation, and that was the weak field approximation that I showed you earlier. So Einstein himself actually convinced himself that they didn't exist. The interesting part of this story is that he submitted a paper to Physical Review, which was actually sent to a reviewer who rejected the paper, and the reviewer was able to convince a protege of Einstein's to convince Einstein that he should redo the calculation, and eventually Einstein did, and in fact, he published a paper in the Franklin Institute, or the Franklin Journal of Science, where he did believe that gravitational waves existed. So he actually came around, so, all right. But why would you build a gravitational wave detector without some kind of proof? And the existence proof for gravitational waves comes from really pioneering radio astronomer experiments by Joseph Taylor and Russell Hulse. These experiments took place over about a 25-year time horizon. And what they did, they measured the orbital decay, in this case of a very special system, a binary pulsar system, all right, where you have two stars. One of them is a pulsar or a clock, so it provides precise timing of the orbit of the system, and it provides precise timing of the orbital decay. And if you fit their data, after taking into account the fact that the Earth moves and all sorts of other factors, you find that the prediction of general relativity fits perfectly over their data. This is very compelling evidence that gravitational waves existed. In fact, they won the 1993 Nobel Prize for this work. This particular source, unfortunately, is not available to LIGO. It's such a low-frequency emitter that it won't coalesce for another 300 million years. How do you detect a gravitational wave? Well, this is a talk about interferometry, so it makes sense that interferometers have evolved. The first way that people tried to detect gravitational waves was to use bar detectors, cryogenic bar detectors. These were both pioneering but also controversial experiments by Joseph Weber in the 1960s, where he claimed actually that a gravitational wave would come in and sort of resonantly ring up a mode in his bar. That was later proven to be not true, but it got two people thinking about how you would make an effective gravitational wave detector, and those two people were Ray Weiss, who is still at MIT, and Ron Drever, who is now at Caltech. And this picture shows a concept of Ray Weiss's gravitational wave detector from a report that he wrote in 1972. And it's a very interesting report because, first of all, the gravitational wave detector that is LIGO today looks a lot, not exactly like, but a lot like this gravitational wave detector here. And more importantly, Ray considered all of the noise sources that one has to worry about to make a sensitive gravitational wave detector. So, how realistically, all right, if you're willing to spend a lot of money and build a big gravitational wave detector, realistically, how sensitive can it be? Well, let's think about it in terms of strain. So what I'm asking here is how much we can split a fringe. All right, so let's think about a simple Michelson interferometer. And let's say that we can roughly measure the strain. That's the differential length between the two arms of the interferometer to basically lambda over L. We can do much better than that, actually, with a simple Michelson, but let's use that as a figure of merit. But now let's start to play some tricks, and the one trick that you can play is you can put Fabry-Perot arms cavities in the arms of the interferometer and basically enhance the amount of time or the amount of round trips that the light spends in each arm of the interferometer, all right? And you can do one more thing. LIGO, for technical reasons, actually works on a dark fringe, so that photodiode doesn't see any light. All right, it actually sees a little bit of light for technical reasons, but it doesn't see any light for the purposes of this discussion. All of the light that hits the beam splitter actually comes back towards the beam splitter. The interference condition is patterned that way. Well, those photons are wasted. All right, they go away. What's important for the sensitivity of the interferometer is how many photons hit the beam splitter. So we can recycle the photons by putting in another mirror. All right, that mirror just sees a light field coming back, and it can be made resonant with that light field to reflect it back into the interferometer. And what that has the effect of doing is putting more photons on the beam splitter, and if I integrate over a certain amount of time, I will be able to increase my sensitivity. So let's put in some numbers. For 1.06 microns, which is where LIGO operates at, for a length of 400 meters or 4,000 meters, 4 kilometers, and for basically a finesse corresponding to about 40 round trips, you get h equals 10 to the minus 21. So This sort of gives you hope that you might be able to build a gravitational wave detector that could see one of these binary events. Now, the other thing that you quickly see is that there's a lot of power that builds up in this interferometer. So LIGO has about 5 watts that goes into the interferometer, but it builds up to 10 kilowatts in each of the arms, and that actually creates some interesting thermal effects. An interferometer is not like a telescope. You can't point it at a particular point in the sky and sense a gravitational wave from there, and that's because it's very insensitive to the direction of the gravitational wave. All right. Depending on the polarization, you get different antenna patterns, but when you combine them together, you get something that is very sensitive to almost any direction whatsoever. There's only a few directions where you have dead zones. So it's really not a telescope. It's more like a microphone. It's really listening for gravitational waves when they come in. The name of the game in gravitational wave detection is understanding the noise that can cause the interferometer to mimic a gravitational wave signal and to try and beat it. All right, and anybody who works in LIGO or anybody in the field of gravitational wave detection knows that the name of the game is beating the fundamental noises and beating the technical noises. So there are two classes of noises. The first class of noise is the noise that shakes the mirror. These are displacement noises. These mirrors have to be held very, very still to be able to detect a gravitational wave. All right. But they can be shaken by a number of things, and anything that displaces the mirror is going to change the interference pattern and lead to a signal on the photodiode that will look like a gravitational wave. So what are those sources? Well, the first is seismic noise. The ground vibrates. It actually vibrates quite dramatically. The second is radiation pressure, because the photons that come in carry momentum, and because the photons have a statistical distribution, a Poissonian distribution, they hit the mirror and provide little impulse kicks to the mirror. That's a noise source because they're kicking the mirror and changing the length. There's also thermal noise. This is basically noise that causes both the suspensions, the mirrors are held by wires and the suspensions can vibrate, and they also vibrate the surfaces of the optics themselves. These are noise sources. There's the second class of noise sources is called sensing noise sources. These are sources that basically come from the detection process. The first is shot noise. Basically, the photons, when they hit the photodetector, are turned into electrons. Photons are quantized. They have a statistical distribution. Second is residual gas noise. As these photons travel through, back and forth through the arms, they can scatter off residual gas, leading to a phase shift, and that phase shift can also mimic a gravitational wave detector. Because of that, the LIGO interferometers are operated completely in vacuum, so the interferometer that I showed you at the beginning, that's totally in vacuum. So we have 4 kilometers times 2 of vacuum pipe inside LIGO. The limiting noise sources are seismic noise at low frequency, suspension thermal noise, this is basically the wires vibrating, and shot noise. Now, people might know shot noise as being white. In fact, here it's because there's a Fabry-Perot cavity that has a cavity pole in it. As I said, LIGO has 2 sites. One is in Hanford, Washington, the other's in Livingston, Louisiana. Hanford has 2 interferometers, one is 4 kilometer long, the other is 2 kilometer long, one is in Louisiana. And the reason for having 2 sites is basically a detection confidence builder. All right? Because noise is something that could fool a gravitational wave detector, and we see glitches in our instruments all the time, by having 2 separate detectors, you can use coincidence detection to rule out spurious events due to noise in one detector. The LIGO observatories, by the way, are run and managed by Caltech and MIT. So what I'm going to do is walk through a couple of the different noise sources that we have now and talk about how we try and get around them. One of the most pernicious noise sources at low frequency is seismic noise. All right. So this is a spectrum, if you will, of the ground motion. It's the amplitude spectral density of the ground motion at the 2 observatories, Livingston and Hanford. And you can see it goes from about 10 millihertz or 100 millihertz up to about 10 hertz. And the low end of that y-axis is at 10 to the minus 11. In order to get the strain sensitivity that we're talking about, we need 10 to the minus 19 meters per root hertz. So we have to work very hard to try and reduce that number by 8 orders of magnitude. How do we do it? We build some of the world's best seismic isolation systems. And the idea is actually quite simple. Harmonic oscillators are wonderful attenuators above their resonant frequency. The transfer function is such that well above the resonant frequency, the motion transfer falls off by 1 over f squared. All right. So by basically putting a bunch of stacks that have different resonant frequencies all lower than the frequency band of interest, we can attenuate by, for 3 seismic stacks, we attenuate by 6 orders of magnitude, and that's actually shown in the blue curve there. The last piece of seismic isolation comes from the mirror suspension, and I'll show you that in a minute. One of the things that you can see from this picture is that because we operate in a vacuum and because we're very worried about contamination, we really work in clean room conditions inside LIGO. The last piece of seismic isolation is the suspended mirrors. I said at the beginning of this talk that we needed mirrors that were freely falling masses. Well, there's no way when you have to hold a mass that you can get a freely falling mass. But in fact, to detect a gravitational wave, you don't need a freely falling mass at all frequencies in all directions. You need a freely falling mass at a frequency of interest that you wanted to detect at in the direction of the motion of the mirrors. So by suspending these mirrors, and if you look very carefully on the picture on the left, you'll see that there's a little wire that comes down and holds that mirror in place. That is the only contact that the mirror has with, physical contact that the mirror has with the outside world. All right, these mirrors have a resonant frequency of about 1 hertz. So at 100 hertz, which is where LIGO is most sensitive, there's a huge attenuation there. Now, the mirrors are freely suspended, but we still have to control them. We have to be able to position these mirrors. We have to be able to hold them in lock. And the way we do that is we use basically very cleverly designed optical sensing and electromagnetic actuation systems where we glue little magnets on the back of the mirrors, and those magnets actually are sensed by a shadow sensor, which then reads the position of the magnet, feeds, and then we can feed back a current which pushes the magnet. All right, as long as that control happens outside of the LIGO band at lower frequencies, we're not pushing the mirror, we're not putting any forces on the mirror in the band of frequency band of interest in LIGO. The mirrors themselves are worth a little bit of discussion. The mirrors are probably some of the best mirrors ever made in terms of their surface figure, in terms of their optical absorption. These mirrors are 10 kilograms in mass, and you want heavy mirrors for a gravitational wave detector. They're polished extraordinarily well to roughly, and the best mirrors are polished to lambda by 1,000, which is a real feat. In fact, LIGO actually pushed some of the development of high precision polishing in the optics community when it was being developed. They also have extraordinarily low absorption. They have extraordinarily high mechanical cues. In other words, the modes are very high, modes of vibration are very highly peaked, and all of these things are necessary to make a sensitive gravitational wave detector. One of the noise sources that we worry about is actually a technical noise source. It's basically frequency noise in our laser. All right, so the lasers have to be stabilized, and they have to be highly stabilized. And LIGO uses a hierarchical approach. Now, people who work with stabilized lasers usually have a reference cavity that they lock their laser to, and that provides adequate stabilization on the order of maybe a hertz to per root hertz in the frequency band that they're interested in. That's not enough for LIGO. So what we have to do is we have to use a hierarchical approach whereby we first lock the laser to a reference cavity. Then we feed the laser to another longer cavity, a so-called mode cleaner cavity, which actually filters the laser light. It filters in both in amplitude, in frequency, and in pointing, so that we make a very stable beam that goes into the interferometer. Because that's a much quieter cavity, that provides more isolation or more frequency stabilization. Ultimately, the laser arms themselves, or the interferometer arms themselves, provide the final level of frequency stabilization, because they are by far the most quiet thing in the interferometer. And we get a frequency stabilization of about 3 × 10⁻²² at 100 hertz. That's per root hertz. That's a very, very impressive amount of frequency stabilization. Now, what's important to remember, actually, is that the laser frequency is actually slewing to follow the arms. The arms can be moving at low frequencies, and the laser is actually following them around. Shot noise and radiation pressure in LIGO, these are competitors, and they're both something that cause the mirrors to move around, and we have to get around them. So the photons obey Poissonian statistics, and your detector doesn't know when a photon hits it whether that photon is coming from the fluctuation of the field due to the statistics of the photons or due to the motion of the mirrors. Right? And you can calculate, if you want a given strain sensitivity for a given power, all right, what is the minimum strain sensitivity that you can get for a given power? And that calculation is shown. On the other hand, you have radiation pressure. And radiation pressure tends to push the mirrors around. All right? In order to get around radiation pressure, you want heavier mirrors, all right, because obviously heavier mirrors are less buffeted by the light. The mirrors are suspended. So if the mirrors are suspended basically by if you suspend the mirrors, you get a 1 over f squared frequency roll-off from that. All right, you can combine those two things together, all right, to calculate something called the standard quantum limit, and this is the absolute best that you can do in LIGO, all right, for the minimum strain sensitivity, all right. And unfortunately, LIGO can't get there, and it can't get there because some of these other noise sources will get there. Advanced LIGO, which I'll talk about a little later, actually will be able to get to this point. This is actually a simple diagram, even though it looks like a complicated one. The real length and readout control scheme for LIGO is much more complex than this, but it shows basically the architecture for how we hold these mirrors on resonance. There is a sideband that is put on the carrier light, and that sideband is resonant inside the short Michelson. All right, and there are sensors in three places, the pickoff port, there's a reflected port, and an anti-symmetric port. And the light fields, basically the sidebands get there and provide a heterodyne signal for the carrier, which when it hits there, it basically beats against the sidebands and provides a homodyne signal. If you phase your readout properly, you can sense all the degrees of freedom of the interferometer. Unfortunately, they're all very connected to each other, so they don't separate very easily, and that's a problem. Nevertheless, it can all be held together. I'm not going to show you the angular readout system. You also have to control basically the angles of the mirrors, because the angles of the mirrors change the amount of power that gets in. They have other issues with the sensitivity of the interferometer, and we've developed a system based on wavefront sensors that actually control those. All right, if you put that all together, all right, this is the best you can do, and this represents basically the LIGO sensitivity, all right, as of about 2 years ago during our last large science run. The black curve is the curve that we said that we would build LIGO. Right, when it was first conceived about 15, actually almost 20 years ago. All right, the blue, red, and yellow, and green curves are the sensitivities of the individual interferometers. And you can see that they fit very well over the science design requirements, except for at low frequencies. And the minimum strain that we can detect at 100 hertz is about 3 times 10 to the minus 23. This is really a remarkable number. So this means that in a frequency band around 150 hertz, we're detecting differential strains better than 10 to the minus 22. If I put that in terms of displacement, in other words, multiply it by the length of the arms, all right, I get a displacement sensitivity of 1.2 times 10 to the minus 19. That's better than an attimeter per root hertz at that frequency. So that's actually quite impressive. Now, unfortunately, the interferometers don't always work this well, because in addition to the noise sources that exist, there are also man-made noise sources and natural noise sources. So this is an example of man-made noise. This is at Hanford. Apparently at Hanford, the LIGO site sits on a DOE reservation, and they conduct drills at night where, for some strange and crazy reason, they drive around with their lights off. All right. And this particular gentleman had the bad luck of driving over this hill and straight into a beam tube cover. So this one didn't cause any problems, but nature does cause problems. If you work in tabletop experiments, you often have your pitfalls with power outages or occasionally floods and things like that. LIGO bears the full brunt of nature when it tries to operate. And these are three examples of how nature has compromised LIGO. The first was, there was an earthquake back in 2001 that was about 200 miles from LIGO, and it caused major damage to the interferometers because it actually, when I talked about the seismic isolation system, you'll remember I said that there are resonances, and those resonances happen to be near the resonant frequency of the ground motion during earthquakes. So the mirrors got rocked around quite a bit, and some of the magnets fell off, and that caused a 3-month delay. A more actually dangerous event was a fire that occurred in Hanford in 2006, I believe. And you can see that LIGO actually, if you look at the lower right-hand picture, LIGO actually provided a service, because one of the beam arms and beam tube covers provided a fire break. So if you look closely, you'll see on the left-hand side, it's all scorched earth, and on the right-hand side, nothing happened because the flame didn't go over the beam tube covers. In Livingston, we have a different hazard, and that hazard is hurricanes. Hurricane Katrina came through in 2005. Fortunately, the Livingston observatory wasn't damaged very much. In addition to LIGO, there are three other gravitational wave projects, and there are lots of reasons for doing this, which I'll say in a second, but let me call them out. The first is Virgo, and it's outside of Pisa, Italy. It's a 3-kilometer interferometer. There's a smaller 600-meter interferometer in Hanover, Germany, GEO 600, and there's a 300-meter interferometer in Tama, Japan. All of these interferometers, actually, most of us work together. And the reason we work together is by having more interferometers on the air, we get a lot of physics that we can't get from one interferometer. First of all, we get more detection confidence. Having more, having gravitational wave be detected by multiple interferometers is good. Because of the distribution around the Earth, it gives us more sky coverage. And because we can get timing information, because when a gravitational wave hits each one of these interferometers, we can do basically triangulation, right, and be able to pinpoint the source in the sky. This is actually something that will be very powerful. We can also look at different polarizations, and there are special ways to analyze the data that actually can even get better. You can dig deeper into the signal to noise by doing what's so-called coherent analysis. All right, so one of the questions that I get quite frequently is, has LIGO detected a gravitational wave? And the answer is no, we haven't detected a gravitational wave yet. The second question I get is, when will LIGO detect a gravitational wave? That one, I quote Yogi Berra, and I say that predictions are difficult, especially about the future. So LIGO's been running for about 3 years, and even though we haven't detected a gravitational wave, we've actually done some pretty neat astrophysics. So what have we done? Well, let me tell you a little bit about some of the sources that we're looking for. I've already told you about the coalescing binary systems. These can be neutron stars, black holes, and they have this nice modeled waveform. We understand from general relativity exactly what the waveform looks like. There are also bursts. These are gravitational wave sources that we don't really understand how to model very well, but we're sure that there will be gravitational waves from them. So a supernova that goes off that has an asymmetric core collapse, some exotic things known as cosmic strings. One of the most interesting sources, but challenging, is the cosmic microwave gravitational wave background, and that's a residue from the Big Bang. I'll talk more about that in a second. There are also continuing sources. Basically, neutron stars can have deformations on them, and if they're spinning, those deformations actually can basically lead to a time-dependent quadrupole that radiates. These are actually very nice. They're monotone sources. They go at a very particular frequency. So over the past 4 years, LIGO's published about 30 papers on astrophysics results, and I just want to highlight one or two here. I'm not an astrophysicist, but I've come in my position to appreciate some of the cool stuff that we're doing astrophysically. The first is basically we can put upper limits on the amount of gravitational wave emission. So the first example I'll give you is the Crab pulsar. This is a remnant of a supernova that went off in 1054. Gravitational waves from, this is a spinning neutron star, it's known, it has a radio signature, and because of the symmetry of the system, the gravitational waves come off at 2 times the electromagnetic frequency. In this case, that 2 times that frequency is close to 60 hertz, which is a nightmare if you're trying to work in a U.S. Laboratory. It turns out that the emission is so narrow that it doesn't actually, we're not affected by, it's far enough off the line that we don't actually see it. Now, This particular pulsar is very young, and because it's very young, it's actually radiating, it's spinning very fast, and it's radiating energy very quickly, so it's spinning down. In other words, it's losing energy to radiation. Now, some of that radiation, of course, comes from the fact that it's a pulsar, and it's basically, has a radiation from it. But some of it could also be due to gravitational wave emission. Now, you could speculate, in this particular case, it would be speculation, that all of the spinning down was due to gravitational wave emission. And you could ask yourself, what would be the strain that you detect? How much of an effect would you see in LIGO? And so we've done that analysis, and what we found is that this particular pulsar is actually, we can put an upper limit on the amount of gravitational waves that it's producing, 4.2 times below that spin down limit, which that doesn't sound too exciting, but I'll put it in a way that actually does sound a little bit better. That means that less than about 4% of the energy is being radiated away in gravitational waves. It could be much less than that, but it's no more than 4%. Moreover, we can put a number on the ellipticity, in other words, how much of a sphere it deviates from, and that number is about 2 times 10 to the minus 4. These things have diameters on the order of 10 or 11 kilometers, so that's about a mountain the size of a meter. So we can say that this particular pulsar has no bumps on it bigger than a meter. This particular pulsar we're not sensitive to because of where it sits in our noise spectrum. We have upper limits on other pulsars where we can say that their bumps are no bigger than 100 microns or so. Another search that we do is we search for gravitational waves from the Big Bang. This is a search basically that we sit there and we integrate our detector noise forever. And as you integrate, because the noise is Gaussian, it should go down, down, down. And if it hits a floor, it'll hit a floor due to the fact that you've hit some intrinsic source of gravitational waves. All right, why is it interesting? Well, it turns out it's interesting because gravitational waves are the only way that you can look back astronomically to the beginning of the universe. Gravitational waves decoupled from the Big Bang, gravity decoupled from the other fields about 10 times 10 to the minus 21 or 22 seconds after the birth of the universe, whereas electromagnetic waves decoupled much later. So there's been a lot of excitement about measuring the cosmic microwave background. That only allows you to look back about 380,000 years. All right, so if you could measure gravitational waves from the stochastic background, you'd literally be able to look at the birth of the universe. So what have we done? Well, we've done a couple of things. First of all, we've actually been able to make upper limit maps of the sky. So this is akin to the cosmic microwave background, but in this case, we're not actually showing gravitational waves, we're showing the upper limits. And you can see the blue areas in these maps correspond to very high sensitivity regions, and the red areas correspond to regions where there might be more gravitational waves coming. But you can make these maps, they're so-called radiometer searches for different classes of cosmology and things like that. And it allows you to give some feeling for what the gravitational wave background might look like. We've also been able to put a number on the amount of density, energy density in the universe due to gravitational waves. So the quantity called omega, which is basically the ratio of the energy of gravitational waves to the critical energy for the closure of the universe. All right, we've been able to show that's a little less than 10 to the minus 5, which is may not seem significant until you realize that this is actually the best measurement that there is in cosmology now for the upper limit for gravitational wave stochastic background. Because we haven't detected any gravitational waves, and because we really didn't expect to detect them with much frequency when we started, we're actually embarking on an upgrade. So this picture shows the local universe, and if you look there, it's 100 million light year scale bar there. You can see what LIGO is. It's the inner sphere. You can see enhanced LIGO, which is the an upgrade that's undergoing right now that will increase our reach by a factor of 2. And then hopefully in 2014 or 2015, we'll basically complete an upgrade that we term advanced LIGO that will increase our sensitivity by a factor of 10 over its current sensitivity and therefore increase our reach into the universe by a factor of 10. That's a big win because the event rate goes up volumetrically, so a factor of 10 in distance is a factor of 1,000 in volume. In the era of advanced LIGO, I would be surprised. People that know a lot more about astronomy than I do would be shocked if advanced LIGO did not detect a few gravitational waves every year, and probably a lot more than that. So the idea is that we're going to basically enhance the sensitivity in every direction. And I'm not going to spend much time talking about the technologies. I'll show you a few of them. But the idea is that we'll use basically higher laser power to get better shot noise. We'll use better suspensions to get better seismic isolations. We'll use better seismic low-frequency active seismic isolation system. And we'll be able to push that noise curve all down. We're going to make a change to the topology of the interferometer, which is actually very important. We're going to add something known as a signal recycling mirror, which I'll show you in a second. That's going to be a big help for our sensitivity. This is schematically what advanced LIGO looks like. If you look, you'll see some differences from what I showed you earlier. First of all, the powers are a lot higher. There's 125 watts hitting the input power recycling mirror. The mirrors look a lot more complicated, and in fact, each mirror is in fact two mirrors, so the suspensions now are not single suspensions, but they're quadruple suspensions. And most importantly, there is a mirror at the dark port, and that's a signal recycling mirror. That actually allows the gravitational wave signal, which spills out of the dark port when a gravitational wave comes in, to be recycled back in, and it can build up. Not only that, you can tune that mirror. You can shift it by a small fraction of a wavelength such that you tune off the carrier and you can actually make your gravitational wave signal more sensitive. So it's like tuning a radio. The thing that actually is probably most impressive about advanced LIGO is the arm cavity powers. There will be 800 kilowatts of light, somewhere between 600 and 800 kilowatts of light stored in the arms. That's average power. These are a bunch of some of the technologies that we're going to use. One is an 180-watt laser. This laser has already been developed, and in fact, last year and perhaps this year, there were some presentations at Clio. The mirror suspensions are more complicated. The mirrors themselves are heavier. They're 40 kilograms, not 10 kilograms. And instead of suspending them with wires, we suspend them with fibers because the fibers actually have better thermal noise performance. The seismic isolation system is an order of magnitude more complicated than what we did in advanced LIGO, or in initial LIGO. Some of the interesting things that we expect to see in advanced LIGO. When you put that much power inside the arms, you get radiation pressure effects. And there's a number of interesting physical things that happen, but they're all guided by the following system, that if the mirrors were just left alone and you put 800 kilowatts in the arms, the mirrors would actually get a force of about 5 millinewton, right, and that would push them out. It would lead to an uncontrolled motion of tens of microns. Well, that's many fringes. Of course, these mirrors aren't uncontrolled. They're forces that we read out the positions of the mirrors and push back. But there are instabilities that can creep in that we worry about. The first is optical springs, dynamical resonances. Because these mirrors are suspended, they're a complicated coupled optomechanical system. So when the mirrors go off resonance, you can either get a pull or a push, depending on the sign of the which side you go off resonance. There are angular tilt instabilities. When the beams get pushed around, they induce torques on the mirrors. And there's also parametric instabilities where basically the beam itself can interact with the normal modes of the test mass of the mirror itself and actually, through Brillouin scattering, basically excite modes in the mirror. And all of these things have consequences for advanced LIGO. So I'll just talk a little bit about each one of them in the couple minutes that I have left. This picture says it all. If I have two mirrors in a cavity, if I change the input angle of the beam into the cavity, I actually induce a restoring force because each one of those, the push exerted by that red arrow actually wants to restore the cavity back to its normal alignment. But the red arrow, if I displace the cavity beam relative to the cavity axis, it actually pushes off. So there's always one unstable mode. And that's a problem because that torque leads to a change in basically it's an extra spring constant on the torsional pendulum. And if the torque gets too big, the spring constant actually goes from negative, from a restoring force to actually positive. All right. And you can actually see that here. These were some experiments that were done by Ron Adhikar at Caltech, where he excited, in this case, the stable mode inside a 12-meter cavity. All right, and by changing the input power, you can watch the resonant frequency move. In this case, because it's stable, the resonant frequency is shifting up. The system is getting stiffer. Parametric instabilities are an interesting consequence, and it's one that we think we understand, but there's still some things that we don't quite understand. Basically, the mirrors themselves have normal modes, and the normal modes, the normal acoustic modes of the mirrors can match some of the laser modes. And when that happens, basically you can get a coupling through scattering where a photon excites or de-excites one of the acoustic modes, and you can cause light to be scattered out of the fundamental mode into the higher order modes or vice versa. Turns out that many of these parametric modes have gain, and because they have gain, they will lead to a loss of arm power cavity. There have been some theory done and some experiments done, but until we get to advanced LIGO, we really won't understand that. One of the most intriguing aspects of advanced LIGO is the fact that when you put a signal recycling mirror in, you do something to the radiation pressure and shot noise, you correlate it. When you correlate it, basically, you can go beyond the standard quantum limit. The standard quantum limit assumes no correlations between shot noise and radiation pressure. They're totally uncorrelated. But when you put the signal recycling mirror in and you feed the gravitational wave signal, you feed the light that hits the signal recycling mirror back in, that introduces dynamical correlations. And if you work out the detailed math, what you'll find is that basically the correlated sensitivity that you get is equal to the standard quantum limit times a term that can be less than one in certain frequency bands. And so the curve that you're looking at there shows, the blue line shows the standard quantum limit, and the pink curve shows the correlated noise due to the fact that when you introduce signal recycling, you can actually squeeze, it's basically a Ponderer mode of squeezing of the light inside the interferometer that leads to better, all right, below standard quantum limit sensitivity. Unfortunately, advanced LIGO is going to have thermal noise that's probably going to cut that off, so we don't know that we'll be able to get there yet. All right, let me finish. The light's going off here. I hope I've convinced you that this is actually a really interesting and exciting endeavor. I think we're getting to the point where we're going to be truly on the verge of gravitational wave astronomy. So the pictures that I'm showing you are basically pictures of different astronomical tools, visible, infrared. This is a cosmic microwave background. There'll be a picture of the Chandra from the Chandra X-ray telescope that actually shows two black holes in the center of a galaxy coming together. And these astronomical tools probe all frequencies, and they give us a picture of the universe as we have it today. Right now, we know nothing about the gravitational wave universe. It's other than some of the theory and the one experiment that was done by Halse and Taylor, it's completely unknown. But with LIGO and with advanced LIGO, we think that we're on the verge of actually doing gravitational wave astronomy. So I would tell you to stay tuned, and hopefully in a few years you'll hear more exciting news about LIGO. Let me thank the members of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. If you look, you might actually see your logo there. There are quite a few people that participate in LIGO. There are many, many countries and many, many universities. Let me thank the members of the LIGO Laboratory and LIGO Scientific Collaboration who really do the hard work to make this interferometer work. The National Science Foundation graciously funds this work, and it's high risk work, but we think it's high payoff work. For more information, you can look here, and I thank you for your attention.